Welcome to ShollyCast, the podcast all about Lolly and Shota, including Not Safe for Work. ShollyCast is hosted by me, Hydro, and Dr. X. We're the developers of Insexual Awakening, a straight Shota visual novel game with incest, lollies, MILFs, onesans, and even a femboy character if you play Insexual Awakening 2, our sequel. If you'd like to play our games, you can download them at our official Barag at barag.net/cyberhex. And if you'd like to support Insexual Awakening's continued development and this podcast, you can join our Subscribestar at subscribestar.adult/cyberhex. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to ShollyCast, everybody. I'm Hydro. I'm with Dr. X. And for this episode, we are joined by Supeku. Welcome, Supeku.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a bit about, so the audience can find out what kind of work you do and what you work on.
It's hard to say specifically. Like, I don't really have a niche or anything like that at the moment yet, I don't think. Because I haven't really been drawing for a very long time, so I'm only really active on Barag, and most of the stuff that I post there is, they're really kind of, you know, for the most part, studies that I do for myself at this point. Because I feel like I'm still at a point where I'm really figuring out the actual basics of drawing and digital painting, etc. And so with each illustration, I just try to do stuff that I haven't really tried before. That takes a while. It's a bit of a stressful process, but at the moment, that's basically what it is. I've got some sort of large project ideas that I'd like to work in the future, but it feels like a bit of a waste of time to, you know, be starting working on like really large projects, like a digital novel or something. I don't feel that confident about drawing in the first place, you know.
So when did you start drawing, or when did you start in your most recent like kind of getting serious about it?
To be honest, I didn't really, I didn't draw at all up until last year.
Oh.
I was always kind of interested in drawing, but it always seemed something like impossible to, not an achiever to like get good at. And I just had, just never even considered, or seriously considered picking it up until, you know, April last year. I did pester my parents to, like, let me go on, like, a painting extracurriculum when I was a teenager. But I did that for a couple of months, and I was awful at it. So I dropped it after that, and then I didn't pick it up for, like, another decade after. I only picked it up last year because, like, I've just been studying and learning different kinds of stuff since COVID started, and that kind of gave me the confidence to, you know, start drawing properly as well.
Oh, that's awesome. And like, I'm looking through your gallery right now, and I do think that you've got some good stuff here.
Thanks.
Lots of great lolly pics. I like it.
Yeah, it's fun.
And you're one of the guests that don't have that story of like they were like 2 years old and already starting drawing and stuff like that. So it's really interesting.
Entering my boomer stage, so like a rarity to. I feel like I need to catch up in a way, I guess. To get my work to a certain level of quality. I didn't have those sort of foundational experience as a child. I feel it's a very, very different experience learning to draw, you know, as an adult compared to, you know, picking up drawing gradually when you're a child, just because I feel like I don't really know how to play with it, you know? Like, I can rationally figure out, you know, how rendering works, or how to go through a digital painting process, or, you know, how to render form, etc. That's all stuff you can learn, but you can't really learn how to play with a drawing, you know, how to fill around with it, kind of enjoy it in a childish, playful way. But it's something that I'm trying to figure out now, because I feel that's something that my illustrations that makes your illustrations lack something. But I'm not sure what.
Well, the good thing is that since you've learned the fundamentals, or it seems like you've started having grasp on it at least, that gives you more room to experiment and not be too frustrated with the results, I would think.
For sure. The frustration seems to, like, never go. I don't know how if it's something that ever, like, properly passes. But yeah, I do find the android process really stressful. I was just thinking, like, quite recently, like, is this something that I'm really... Yeah, it's good weird. Is this something that I'm really enjoying, I guess? But I am enjoying it. Like, I enjoy creating something, but the actual process can be sort of... It makes me want to pull my hair out half the time, you know? How do you guys find it?
Dr. X and I, well, Dr. X is multifaceted. He started off with programming mainly, but then as we kept working together on the IA series, especially IA 2, he then went into learning about, you know, 3D rendering and like animation using like Koikatsu and then modeling and rights. And for me, I mainly focused on writing. However, I can totally relate with you when it comes to the music creation experience, because I've wanted to be working on music and creating my own music since I was like, oh, probably like 15 or 16, ever since I heard Daft Punk's Discovery album.
Nice.
And that was kind of my starting point of like, it kind of was amazing, because I know some people, you know, when they get into music, it's they sometimes either just, it's kind of like just like what happens with drawing with some people, they just start having fun with it and experimenting when they're a kid. And for me, it wasn't that. I hated learning the piano when I was younger. Hated it, and I just never got into it. But then once this album came along with Daft Punk, I like all of a sudden had just this moment where I'm like, man, I want to make music just like them. And since that time, it's been a real struggle with like, I'll have an idea for a song or I'll think of a song, but then the actual process of making it is incredibly, can really be tough and can really be complicated and very, very slow. And it's tricky because you, especially with like, well, it's probably the same with artwork for you too. Like, do you ever have moments where you'll see some really great art, right? You'll see some really great Cunny or something. And you'll be like, oh man, I really want to draw that, but you only are looking at it from the context of the finished piece, right? So it's the same thing with music. You're listening to the final product after who knows how many hours or days it was worked on and processed and gone through audio effects and all the different recordings. So you don't know where it started off bare bones. You don't know where it began from, and sometimes it can be a mystery to figure out how to navigate that whole process.
Yeah, that's really interesting perspective. It's interesting to hear sort of how experiences and approaches to arts can be very similar, even in like radically different types. Well, I mean, types of creation. I was just thinking recently, and this kind of ties in with the last thing. When I was a bit younger, I used to do theater quite a bit. I used to do it at 10, actually, up until a few years ago. And the thing with acting is that you need to have sort of absolute confidence, absolute control over your body to really have any chance of having a convincing performance, right? And this isn't like a huge secret or anything, like it's... If you ask anyone who's done acting in, like, any sort of way, they will most likely agree with this, right? And the sort of the confidence that you need, that's separate from... You can actually be enough very skilled artist, as long as the confidence is that you can make a fairly convincing performance. But I always sort of thought that this was something that's exclusive to, like, the performative arts. But going recently, I've been thinking about my sort of drawing and sketching process a very similar way. You really can't make sort of interesting and engaging illustrations unless you're in a strange way sort of letting go of the rational part of your brain and just letting your body sketch and create these gestures and shapes and expressions kind of almost subconsciously. Yeah, I feel like that's a really surprisingly large part of making excellent illustrations. And when you look at pieces who are made by really, really, really big artists, you know, Jochen Siva, you've got all this expression on top of the technical skill. And I really don't think that's gesture, expression, etc. is something that you can rationally sort of think out of. You kind of just need to let go of your body and let your arms make the marks. And then afterwards you rationally detail and talk alone.
Yeah, I've seen some discussions about that, about the confidence thing in art, and I've seen it mentioned that, like, sometimes if the artist is very insecure, it'll show up in the art. Like, maybe the lines will be more wobbly and they won't look as clear or definite.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it's a weird one. You just kind of have to basically not overthink things. Which is strange because drawing feels like... I didn't realize this before I started learning to draw, but it's a very sort of rational, almost intellectual process. Like, there's so much. There's an incredible amount of studying and understanding involved in creating a, you know, three-dimensional form, you know? And then playground with stuff like light, form, shadow, whatever, anything. It's a great deal of knowledge required to create a really complex piece.
Yeah, it's like, just with like perspective, for instance, like that itself is math-based, because we're kind of trying to mimic like real life, like photography or physics, or how light, like, you know, light moves, or how our eyeballs see reality and stuff like that. So
yeah, I know.
Yeah, and it's really amazing the artists who learn that stuff, because like at some point you ideally want to be able to do it intuitively, even though it's a math based thing.
I think one of the really big challenges in drawing is sort of being able to sort of take this intuitive part of your brain. Intuitive is the right word. Take this intuitive part, kind of unconscious part of your brain, which, you know, really comes out when you're doing quick sketches and, you know, like loose marks, etc. And then combine that then with the little conscious, your wrestle part of the brain, where you start adding detail, light, you know, specific form, etc. And being able to maintain the sort of expressiveness of the early sketch, like subconscious expressiveness of the early sketch, as you keep working through, you know, and detailing your piece, I think is one of the big challenges, or at least that's one of the big challenges for me in drawing, you know.
Interesting. What do you think is the next stage for you? Is there anything specific that you really want to learn for your making your art?
Oh, well, I'd like to sort of get better at rendering form in general. Something that I've been working through. I've been looking at a lot of rendering work by Diaphone, and that's a genius. Yeah, and trying to figure out what he does. Basically, the way that I learn is I'll take up an artist that I really like, and I'll try to essentially imitate the work for a couple of weeks, and even see if I can sort of learn anything from it. And yeah, obviously you can learn. You can always learn something from people who actually know what they're doing. But I guess, like, stuff that I'd really like to learn, as I said, just kind of playfulness. I'd like to learn to sort of mess around with my art a little bit more, because I've still got this massive mindset where, well, the way I approach a piece is, I mean, you do need to have planning, but I'd like to sort of, in a way, I guess maybe let go of doing thumbnailing and loose sketching and just find a way to get more gesture out of my drawings, I guess. But it's strange because it's not something that you can really rationally learn, as I say. It's something that kind of a feeling, a mindset, or then you have something that you learn. So something I've been struggling with. But yeah, it's just something that I've been thinking about over the past couple of weeks or so.
That is interesting. And I think what would be great for as we get more artists on the podcast, and if they're struggling with something, is that if in the comments, if there's other artists who want to share some kind of insight or advice or learnings with the guest, or even other people who might be looking in the comments, that would be actually be really cool.
Yeah, no, that is super welcome.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Like helping each other out and everything. Because we're all, everyone's on their art journey on Bragg and other places.
The film.
Have you seen the tutorials made by Direthon? I could have sworn I saw it on some website.
I don't think so. No, I don't think I've seen any of the tutorials by him. I'll have to have a look.
Yeah, I'll have to send that to you so you can have a look at that.
Nice, thanks.
I was surprised because I was like, I recognize that name. Yeah. So yeah, that might help you out.
I know for sure, thanks. Yeah, people in Bragg, it's interesting to see like how nice of a community that Bragg actually is compared to most pages on the internet. Despite the fact that it's not huge, but it is only what, 40,000-50,000 regular users, isn't it?
I'm pretty sure it's up around that number. It's probably more than that now, but since Koi had closed off registrations, I think since last year, that's obviously limited the number of people that have gotten on. But yeah, I mean, there's easily, 50,000 to 60,000 people on there. And many of them, if not the majority of them now, are usually creators in some capacity. They're either artists or writers or anything like that, because that's primarily what the Bragg community is.
Here's an interesting part of it is that I think there's a lot of reasons why the Bragg community is so nice, but I think one of them is because, like, okay, if you're a lolly artist, you make a lot of lolly art, and I'm sure you probably make art of other stuff too, but as far as Bragg goes, it's a lot of lolly art, and like, there's not a whole lot of lolly tutorials out there, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like we have to rely on ourselves and on each other, right, to say. Because it's not that easy to like go on Google and look up drawing lolly tutorial or something. Especially for the NSFW stuff, like, boy,
it's like non-existent.
I think I found like maybe one of them that was NSFW for drawing a lolly. Not even super NSFW, but kind of. But it was in Japanese, I think. So.
No, of course it was.
Yep.
Yeah, no, that is a good point. I guess it's also sort of like it's a acceptance of sexuality thing as well, because I think there's a lot of shame and guilt associated with, like liking lolly show stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
In general, I think people who, accept their sexuality just tend to be happier and nicer in them.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Yeah.
Yep.
You can kind of see this in the furry community as well, which I feel as the furry community is quite nice. I'm not glad I'm knowledgeable about the furry community, or like as knowledgeable about it as the lolly community, lolly show community, but it also seems like a really, really nice one. Which is also interesting again, because it is a quite sexual community as well.
Yeah, like when it comes to NSFW communities, you kind of, a lot of the times they're past that kind of barrier about like, oh, like sexuality in general is bad, like don't masturbate and stuff like that.
No, exactly.
Like, we've seen, some people on the internet say like, don't masturbate because, I don't know, like you're like removing your male essence or something like that. But, in porn communities, they're not saying that shit. They've gotten past that barrier. And as far as Bragg goes, because like, there's plenty of lolly show on Bragg. You're pretty much past the barrier of like having a problem with something being depicted in fiction in general. Like, if you accept lolly, you're probably gonna accept whatever else fetish. It could be bestiality or non-con or whatever. It could be anything. So, and also like, and I think especially for people who are into a lolly show, like we know what it's like to be judged and met with prejudice of some kind or hate or whatever. And so a lot of us thankfully understand that we didn't like that, so we shouldn't like treat other people like that either.
Sean. Yeah.
Even if they have a fetish that we're not into, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I find this whole subject kind of fascinating. Yeah, even despite the fact, that obviously have all this acceptance. The community has all this acceptance over sexuality, etc. It's still interesting to see that just how sort of nice and non-toxic is, because it feels like, you shouldn't run into that angst every so often. despite the fact that, you know, okay, you've had, you know, these experiences, etc., which you really don't, is just really, really nice on a really mass scale.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I just find it really fascinating. And yeah, I do think it is something to do with, you know, self-acceptance.
Yes, for sure.
And your own, like, sexuality, so a huge influence. You know, it's a shame that, you know, people outside, like, these board communities, yeah, don't often have the opportunity to sort of think about their sexuality in a more introspective way, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm trying to think about how to help that issue. Like, it's, you know, doing this podcast, I want to use a podcast to help people or help the community and be, like, more sex positive and stuff. So I've been trying to figure out how to help that. And I think just doing this podcast helps a lot, because on this podcast, everyone can talk about their kink or fetish or whatever it is.
Totally.
Without, you know, fear of judgment. Like, no one gets judged on this podcast if whatever you're into, you know what I mean?
Damn.
So I think it's a great thing, because you don't see that a lot on podcasts, other podcasts either. Like, even the ones that talk about sexuality or whatever, they might draw the line at Lolly Show or something.
And I exactly am.
But here, you know, like, it doesn't matter what you're into, as long as you're not hurting anyone, and you can be into whatever you want. It's okay.
No, exactly. Yeah, it's an excellent thing you're doing. But yeah, the issue is that this doesn't really have, you know, unfortunately, because of the subjects it covers, it doesn't really have that kind of mass appeal or, like, access to a mass audience. Like, ultimately, it's still gonna be people, likely in the Lolly Show community, and, you know, shame and guilt around sexuality is a huge societal issue in general. No, I don't think it's something that's sort of very easily approached or very easily fixed, unfortunately.
I think that, like, what we're doing and what Bragg is doing, what Athey is doing, really helps, is that building that community around people who are okay with all kinds of fictional content. So, I mean, that's why the podcast hasn't been exclusively about Lolly Show.
Yeah.
We talk to people who are into other stuff, because we're all brothers and sisters, you could say, in this. Because it's not just Lolly Show that gets banned off of Patreon, as we know. Like, incest gets banned. Non-con and bestiality,
and goblins too, apparently, now, and
like furry genitalia, you know, like red rocket shit, that's been in Patreon sites
really
recently. Yes,
yeah, that's on the chopping block. Yep.
Yeah, there's been some mixed signals, but overall it's kind of dubious whether you can do it. And you know, like, back in, not to harp on this too much, but, you know, back in the day, I remember there were some people who were, like, kind of cheerleading for Lolly and Shota and, you know, incest, whatever, getting banned off of Patreon. And I thought back then, like, what are you going to do when, like, they ban your fetish? You know what I mean? So it's like, and which it did end up happening a lot of the time, is that the same people who are, like, wanted that stuff banned end up having their stuff banned. So what it really comes down to is just, like, we shouldn't, like, try to put other people down in order for us to gain some kind of advantage. You know, we shouldn't say, like, you know, for obviously in this example, be like, oh, you know, fuck those Lolly Show people, because at least I'm not doing Lolly Show. I know I'm doing, like, furry cocks and stuff, but at least it's not Lolly Show.
Or I'm doing hypnosis or coercion, and yeah, it's kind of the strange moral grandstanding over other fetishes and stuff.
We need to move past the era or mindset of putting other people down so that we can put ourselves up. We need to stop that, because what we need to do is you know, raise everyone up, help everyone, not just ourselves.
Down. Yeah, I think, the issue, I guess, is that Lolly Show is just, I feel like it's an extra fringe. So in modern society, it's an even all fringe community, probably the sexual ones, obviously, because the subject matter.
Yeah.
The funny thing about that, though, is like, when you look at the, for example, like VTubers like Gargura or that Lolly music video that, like, blew up on YouTube and stuff, it tells you, though, that even if that there is a divide or a little bit of a rift between the safe work and not safe work, the popularity of Lolly and Shota's undeniably strong. Well, like, it's definitely popular. It's just, and you know, Dr. X and I were talking about this the other day, that we have a funny feeling that there probably are a ton of people that just won't say that they do like the NSFW side of Lolly Shota. It's just right now, it's not at a point where I think they're willing to kind of step over to the other side, so to speak, and be like, yeah, I do want to see Anya Forger's pussy. I do want to see it.
Relatable.
I think very relatable. I bet you're, you're right on the mark, but... Yeah, I think it's a significant part of the population that are actually into it. But I think it's not even sort of being open about it, right? I think people are, you know, used to have this sort of thing with, like, gay people, you know, back in the 20th century as well, right? Like, people would refuse to accept their sexuality, and, you know, I mean, it just ends up meaning that they're, you know, I've got a lot of issues of mental health, they're unhappy in general, folks. I think there's a lot of people who are probably sort of subconsciously into Lolly Show stuff that actually don't realize it, again, because of all the moralizing and shaming that happens around it in society, you know?
Yes. Like, where they can't even, like, accept the possibility of it.
No, exactly.
So they won't let themselves explore that, or maybe they see a pic of a Lolly and they're like, they feel something, but they just deny it, you know what I mean? Because they don't want to, because of that stigma. And, you know, we're trying to help with that stigma with the podcast and, you know, all that stuff. And even though it's mostly targeted towards people already in the community, I think it still does help. And who knows, you know, there might be someone who's kind of on the fence about it, and they listen to the podcast and they realize that we have all these people on the podcast, and we're not talking about like sacrificing people at the altar or something evil like that. And like, we're just regular people.
You're working for self-acceptance in terms of your sexuality. And this isn't even, it's, you know, just for open show stuff. It requires, you know, a ton of work, a ton of introspection. Again, like, our society is so anti-sex anything, you know, sex is just so incredibly repressed as a sexuality from a super young age.
Yeah.
You know, like, you see this in TV, it says, well, you know, like, going extreme violence is absolutely fine, but,
yeah,
like, God forbids, you see, peeking going into the JJ, you know, that's like being in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even when you look at the old Disney movies that are, you know, they're rated G. They're supposed to be for basically toddlers. And yet some of those Disney movies have a lot of violence in them.
Like, remember Lion King?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, spoilers for like a 100-year-old movie, by the way. where, like, there's a scene, like, at the very end where, like, that, like, Scar is, like, thrown off the cliff or whatever. And then he gets, like, he lands in, like, a pit of, like, hungry and pissed off hyenas. And basically the scene gives across the impression that he gets eaten alive by them. And that's kind of fucking dark for, you know what I mean?
Yes, it is.
And, yeah, I think you're onto something. I think you're onto something where, like, I mean, I know that was, like, a scene where, like, he was a villain, but still. He was gonna get eaten alive, basically. But like you said, if there's a nipple on TV or in a movie, that's a big deal for some reason.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, when you really sort of when you get into it with this sort of stuff, and you sort of start thinking about, you know, the way that sexuality is depicted in media, the way that people discuss sexuality, you know, outside, on the internet, etc., you just really start noticing how careful people are with their words.
Yeah.
How insecure people are, you know, grossing certain topics. There's no real reason for anyone to be that way, right? Because sex is, like, actually one of the most normal things possible, right? Like, it's a very natural, normal thing. Like, we're literally all created through sex. And then the fact that our society what represses this, you know, basically the basis of our existence, to the point where, you know, like telling your friends you like feet or something is like
a big deal.
A really, really big deal is just I just find it really, really strange.
Yeah.
And you know, people talk about sexual revolution, you know, those 70s and 80s, but I feel like sexuality's only gotten more oppressed as time has gone on. The internet's been kind of a breaking point in a way, because you're able to have communities like these, you know, where we're able to discuss sexual things, pornography, etc. But still on a mass scale, the average person is just, yeah, still has a ton of guilt associated with anything sex-related.
It was because they're raised that way.
Yeah. And
I guess it's important, like, for the people who are sex positive to try to break that cycle. I think that's really important, so.
The show on Yed, so clouded with friends, etc.
Yes, like, don't be afraid to be a nice person, is what I want to say. Don't be afraid to be accepting. Don't be afraid to be tolerant. Don't be afraid to not be prejudiced, you know, because some people are, they might treat another person with intolerance or might judge them because they're afraid that if they don't do it, they'll be met with stigma themselves. And we need to realize that that just increases stigma in society, which eventually goes back to you, of course, because you're part of society. So you should just, you know, try to improve society for everyone. And yeah, you're right. You know, like accepting yourself, your sexual feelings and stuff, that's like super important for your mental health. Like, it doesn't have to be like about Lolly Show. Like you said, it's anything. Like, for example, if you're gay or bisexual, if you have these feelings that, oh, that makes me bad or evil or whatever, it's not good for your mental health. So it's really important to accept ourselves.
Yeah.
Our sexual feelings. Like almost everyone has sexual feelings and none of us choose what they are. So it's a very important thing for us to accept it.
Yeah, there's no escaping your sexuality. It is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's important to sort of think about it introspectively. Even you know, I guess for people who do accept it, I think it's worthwhile to think about the way you perceive and think about more in specific, actually. Because I feel like a lot of people, even who are sort of sex positive, still tend to have sort of, I guess, just negativity in general towards pornography, sluts, like, well, the general public. Porn is perceived as something that's very, I don't know, low-grow, grass, etc. It's actually the same kind of art form as absolutely any other, right? Because there's nothing that makes pornography sort of wrong, you know?
Yeah. And there's like plenty of like, I mean, there's plenty of like horror films out there, people getting cut up and, you know, everything like that.
Exactly, exactly. And that's a very good point. You know, like, violence porn is almost normal, isn't it?
I like how you call it violence porn. I think that's because, I mean, in the podcast, in another episode, we were like talking about like, it doesn't really matter whether you enjoy something sexually or not. You know what I mean? It doesn't make it, if you enjoy something sexually, doesn't mean it's worse. It's like, it's worse to enjoy it that way.
Exactly, yeah. And sort of sexual media in general, there's nothing, it's media, same as anything else.
Yeah.
This is something that I've always sort of recently started thinking about myself, because I feel like I've always thought, okay, well, you have, you know, all forms of art here, you know, and then goes in this box. So that's, you know, sort of safer work, painting, theater, film, etc. That goes in this box. And then you have like smut and porn, fictional or non-fictional, and that goes in this box. So like they're all separate things. But there's nothing particular or different about pornography other than the fact that it includes sex, but it's all same, ultimately. It's all the same art.
I think there's a lot of people who think about it in the way we do, like you and I or Hydra, but it's just that as of right now, maybe not a whole lot of them are sharing their opinion about it. In other words, what I'm saying is maybe a lot of people are closeted about it, where they feel like, you know, porn is not a big deal, but they just haven't told anyone because they're afraid to, because of the stigma. They don't want to be thought of as the weirdo or something like that. So it is important, though, you know, for us to speak up if we have the courage to do so about our feelings about that.
For sure.
So we can kind of tear down that stigma against sex in society. I have the fortune of, for the most part, not feeling that bad about sex throughout my life. I've had people try to make me feel bad about sex, that's for sure.
Yeah, same, yeah.
Like my parents or random people on the internet, you know, people in religion, whatever. But thankfully, it hasn't worked for me. That hasn't worked on me. It didn't. They were not convincing for me. And so that's part of why, I guess, it's almost like a duty for me, I guess, on a personal level, of course, because I don't have that, you know, personal stigma against sex, that I speak on it because I have that privilege of not really feeling that bad about it. So I can use my voice to help other people who may not be at the same stage that I am at.
For sure. Speaking of which, just out of curiosity, what compels you to make erotic media and pornography in general, you think? Because I feel like people say, you know, like, oh, well, it's just hot, you know? But I feel like that isn't the whole picture. I'm just curious as to, you know, yeah, what makes people do what they do?
It's really interesting to explore, like, different facets of humanity, which, I mean, okay, well, we're making Sexual Awakening, right? So it has Shota, Lolly, incest, a whole bunch of good, very good stuff.
The hell here you are.
But because we're doing that, we're exploring a lot of things about humans or sexuality that isn't explored in a lot of other media because they're afraid to touch that subject or something. So I think it's very interesting. And like, I mean, I'll mention one example is that in our games, we have incest, for example, and exploring that and portraying it in a way that is not like, you know, just uniformly negative is very interesting. And it feels very freeing, right? Because we're not like weighed down by like having to tell everyone or trying to signal to everyone, oh, this is bad. Hydra even has that story that like one of the reasons why he originally created the Sexual Awakening is that he had been playing this game that had incest in it, and like the game pretty much tried to make the player feel bad for doing the incest.
Genius.
And that really didn't resonate with Hydra.
Orion's.
Yeah, you basically get a bad end essentially if you pursue it, and it's pretty stupid. And the other game that I played, it's like it was a bit more basic, but it was like, it did have incest in it, but the story actually restricted what kind of incest would take place. And it wasn't really the central focus after it kind of seemed to imply that it was going to happen. And I was just kind of like, no, I want to create my own story. In terms of like what you had asked about, like how did we like kind of get into, or like why do we create it? I think it's the same as what Dr. X has said. It's like it's very freeing to explore something that you don't usually see depicted very much, or is more niche, or like you know I feel like it's almost like human nature to want to explore things that are taboo, or explore things that maybe not everyone accepts or not everyone is into all the time, or maybe that's just the way the creative people are. I feel like creative people especially are like that. They love going against the grain, but it's that going against the grain is often what brings about societal change a lot of times. I mean when you think about it, how often have major shifts in like culture, I mean, what is culture when you think about it? Culture usually consists of creative stuff. You know, like the, you know, when Edison or whoever, like, in, you know, there's tons and tons of different inventions that have come up, right? Like, you know, the Franklin stove, for example, Benjamin Franklin, he thought up, he was just like, man, I'm really fucking cold. This sucks being in colonial times. Well, you know what? I want to make something that'll warm up my house. And then he started to be creative with it. And that totally shifted how people heat their homes. And that was a creative thing he was thinking of, you know, as a, but also there's like books and art and, you know, like, what is the, why do they call it the Renaissance? Well, it's because mostly it was all cultural stuff. It was music. It was art that totally shifted how everybody felt.
Yeah. And in the Renaissance, they were exploring a lot of things that were considered taboo or things not to talk about in like the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, whatever you want to call it. Right. And that's why the Renaissance was so pivotal, is that they were studying and learning and celebrating and, a whole bunch of stuff that was considered off limits previously. And as we talked about, some things are taboo when they really shouldn't be. Like, it shouldn't be taboo to say, like, yeah, I like furry stuff, or like, I like feet.
Yeah, we are exactly, you know.
Taboo isn't necessarily bad. It's not necessarily an immoral thing. And the other thing I want to mention about, like, why do we make the kind of art we do and the stories we make, is that it helps people too. Obviously, there's a sexual element. It helps them sexually, which, you know, that's cool. But, you know, we have a community of people who enjoy our games, and we try to be nice and tolerant with everyone. And they've told us that, like, the game has improved their lives because, well, in Sexual Awakening, it's a very good feeling game series, where, like, we try to make people feel good, not just sexually, but, like, just in general, like, emotionally. With our games, where they play and they feel good, it's a nice environment and nice story where you feel relaxed.
They are very awesome. You know, we played the second one, but it is very wholesome.
Yes, it is. It's very wholesome, and it has improved the mental health of some people because of that. So, like, it helps people. That's one of the reasons why I keep doing it, and it matters a lot to a lot of us. It matters to me and Hydra, of course. So that's another reason why we do it. But it helps people. And I think, yeah, I'm really glad you brought up this topic, because, like, porn is not just about, like, getting a boner and jerking off and stuff like that. Another thing in porn is that you can portray different body types that don't get as much respect as it should in other places, or different kinds of characters or people. I mean, with Shonen Lolly, like, a lot of the people can be like for example, in, like, the self-insert thing. If someone is of a smaller stature or lighter build, for example, they might see themselves a little bit in the shoulders or lollies, or maybe that's their more ideal body type, like, for themselves. Like,
yeah,
they would enjoy having a smaller body or younger body, so they can self-insert that way, and that matters, because, I mean, you know, there's the whole thing about body dysmorphia and stuff, and with porn you can have a much more, I guess, over, like, examples of, like, different sexualities and stuff, like homosexual sexuality. I mean, there's the whole thing on TV, which it's probably still true, honestly, where, like, when, like, gay relationships are portrayed, they're more chaste on TV, for example, especially in the past, where, like, you know, like, I guess a good example would be, like in the same show where, like, there'd be, like, a straight couple, like, under the covers in bed, like, presumably having sex. Like, the gay couples would only get, like, a kiss on the cheek or something in the show.
Oh, that's a good point. That's very good points, yeah.
Right. And but in porn, you have, you know, two burly guys going at it, fucking each other, or two lesbians scissoring and stuff like that, right? So there's less limits. Yeah, and that's a great thing, because a lot of people want representation, and that can be found in porn. Yeah, it's a very interesting thing to talk about, and I'd love to talk about it more in like a dedicated episode or something, like, about how porn can be used for good. It's not just about a bunch of sweaty guys masturbating. I mean, that's fine, but, you know, it's more than that. It's more than, like, the highly, like, caricaturized, you know, view of what porn is, some kind of, like, dirty thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's Yeah, just going off of what you said, it's interesting, but sort of, yeah, porn is almost an expression, and, you know, the human form and the human forms, you know, and sort of almost an appreciation of his beauty in that way. And then what he started thinking about fetishes as well is, you know, like body parts that fetishes, they're almost sort of a means of expressing, you know, the beauty of like very specific details of the human form.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of, I guess it's kind of interesting to think about.
I mean, the example like, that came to mind was feet. Because there's like the feet fetish, like, but some people think like feet are disgusting or something. Another thing to mention, like some people might think that their feet are disgusting, but maybe they see some porn that is like real super into feet. Maybe they'll feel a little less bad about it.
Yeah.
Or maybe someone is like heavier and maybe they'll feel bad about it, but then they see porn and all these people like celebrating like bigger women with like bigger bellies or whatever and like feel less bad about it. So like there's tons that can go into it that can help people, you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, because I think, yeah, the thing is, like, fundamentally, porn is when people create pornography, it's sort of a form of expressing what they find beautiful about it. And even that even goes for, you know, really fringe or dislike fetishes that people might think are disgusting. That's still, you know, despite the fact that they might be unappealing, I guess. I don't know what the unappealing for the mass audience, I guess. But the fact that it's still sort of an expression of beauty from the person that is creating it. And I think it's interesting to sort of think thinking about pornography in that way, because that almost takes away that sort of lowbrow, sort of lowness of pornography when you think about that it is an expression of beauty. Even if it's like, I don't know, Scott or something, you know, ultimately the person who is making it sees something in there that other people do not, you know, perhaps, or, well, yeah, just, yeah, sees something beautiful in it. I just think it's really sort of fascinating from when the academic and the viewer perspective, you know.
Oh, definitely, yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. It is very fascinating. I could talk about this for hours, honestly.
The wall heavy too, yeah.
There is a question we wanted to ask you, as we asked most of the guests, is how did you get into Lolly or Shota in the first place? I would assume it's mostly Lolly.
Mostly Lolly. I'm a traverse person in the first place. So like, I'm very uber for like all different kinds of sexual experiences.
I see you are a man of culture as well. Good.
Yes, we are all men of culture. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't mind shot of stuff. But yeah, it was primarily Lolly, though. Yeah, that's the big thing for me. Same as everyone. It started off when I was quite young. Maybe a little bit sort of differently from some of the people here. I didn't really start watching anime or anything like that up until I was in my 20s. And I feel like anime is a media form that where you get, like, a particularly high concentration of, like, Lolly show characters.
Oh yeah, big time.
Yeah, I didn't have tons of exposure to them up until I got older. Not a few, like, I'm always thinking about this because at some point you ask everyone, I was thinking about it. And I think the earliest sort of memory of it I have is I was playing, like, what are the early Pokemon games? Let it be, like, Leaf Green, maybe? I'm not actually even that much of a Pokemon head, but when I was little, I'd play it because my brother had it. So yeah, so also, I think it was Leaf Green and one of one of the earlier games. And I just remember I'd really, like, whenever old Lolly sort of trainers come out, and there weren't a ton of them, and it wasn't sexual or anything at this point, I don't think, but I just remember really liking it, just getting super hyped for whatever I had to fight, like a Lolly trainer. But other than that, after that, I think it was probably Deadman. It was probably Shed Hiss that kind of opens the world of like Lollipop, etc., to me, because I wasn't aware that it was a playing up until that point when I was nearly 13, 14, and Shed Bass was like opening up, I guess.
So growing up, or at least when at the time you knew you liked Lolly and SFW, like, what were your favorite Lolly characters?
Yeah, favorite Lolly characters? Shit. I should have thought about this beforehand.
It seems like you like jazz from Stardew Valley.
I do like, at the moment, I do like jazz. I'm not too sure why.
She's very cute. For once, anything that helps.
That does do it. But, yeah, I think I quite like... I just like about Jan, the thing that I like about her character in that... Because it's, Well, because her character design, like, all the characters in Stardew Valley are sprites, right? And they're not sort of very high detail or anything like that. That leaves you a ton of creativity in, you know, depicting a character sort of as you imagine it, instead of, like, exactly how they're supposed to be, I guess, or anything like that. Because where you have very sort of... where you have very sort of realistic... precise minutes, you know, depictions of characters. But that's, you know, that's it. That's the character. Like, there's no much... It becomes a lot more difficult to play around with what they actually look like. But what if I jazz trips on you? Yeah, because she's... you know, she's got features then, but she's still like a pixelated mess. You know, you get to play around with and sort of design her character in different ways. And so, yeah, if you look at my illustrations, you get to see, like, my real lows and highs there, I guess, in general, in terms of my art, but I depict her, like, very differently each time. And yeah, it's because of just sort of gives me the space to play around with character design and different forms of stylization, etc. So I guess it's not even necessarily... Maybe the fact that they aren't sort of very high fidelity characters is part of what, you know, attracts me to them. Because the same way that, like, I've had the attraction to Ultima and Trader sprites for, like, the old as well, right? Because that kind of leaves space for fantasy and interpretation.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I don't really mean, but yeah, Jess is still, like, I'm not really, I kind of meme about it, but I'm not, like, super obsessed about Jess on the bad.
Have you played the mod with her?
I have, yeah, of course I have. I'm not much of actually, like, this is part of the problem that I run into. Like, I don't really game or work much. Up until, like, a few years ago, I didn't really watch anime or anything like that, watch at all. So, I'm really, like, really falling behind the terms of, like, pop culture understanding, etc. That also, like, leaves me less space for, like, appreciating Lolly and Shota characters in media as well.
Well, there's always time to get caught up.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I don't think I had any sort of... Yeah, I don't really think I had any sort of specific Lolly grudged when I was growing up.
Just more of a Lolly thing in general.
It's a Lolly thing in general, yeah. Maybe if I dug around in the old rod a little bit, I'd pick something up. But yeah, contrary to call it a thing of Lollies. But yeah, it's what Lolly stuff in general is. Yeah, is the big one. Because I just feel like a lot more attraction to those kind of characters than, I don't know, like, adults. New representations of panthers.
Oh, so you much more prefer Lollies compared to, like, adult women characters.
Oh, yeah. God, I remember I had this, I guess, like, again, because I've been a very sort of novice from basically the point where I became aware of my sexuality when I was a kid. Because I remember I went to school, and, you know, this would have been when I was, like, 11 or 12, so I was sort of starting to figure out, you know, the sexuality and started to become attracted to things, etc. And I went to school, and some kids were, like, talking about Pornhub, and they're like, whoa, Eddie, heard of the Pornhub? You can watch Maze. Ooh, it's boobies. I was like, well, that sounds pretty good. So we'll check that out. And I got back home, you know, and I turn on the Pornhub. I just pop on, like, one of the top videos, like, whatever, on the front page. I was just like, is this it? Like, it's just, like, being boobied woman? A vagina? Ketis? I like, this is shit. Yeah, but, like, this does nothing for me. So, yeah, it was really... most of my sexual experience, like, sexualization, I guess, was, like, fantasizing about stalker ramp and watching porn. And it wasn't until I discovered, like, fictional pornography through, again, through Shavaman, that I became, I didn't become a Guna. I'm not a Guna now either, but that I sort of started. Thought as though enjoying pornography in general. Mm.
Seems like you were destined to be a lolly man, basically.
Here's your head's made for this.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think when I started finding more like fictional like porn and fictional NSFW, that really elevated my like appreciation of porn. I was just like, oh man, yeah, now this is what I really like. This is the real good stuff.
So Hyder, did you find a real life porn before the fictional porn?
Yes, I believe so, because I think for me it was literally like the Playboy channel, because like I had like a de-scrambler or whatever, which like at the time, like, because, you know, internet was not really a thing, like I didn't even have internet back then, but I did have like a de-scrambler, and I remember it was channel 98 was the Playboy channel, but it would only come in like in red. Like it would be like this reddish blackish hue, almost like you were playing on one of those Game Boy that like crazy Game Boy thing, the virtual reality one they made back in the 90s. That's kind of what it looked like. But I remember that was good enough for me, though. That was perfectly fine for me.
It was red and blue.
No, it was red and like black. Like it was basically that. It was basically the skin was red, and then like there was black.
Creepypasta colors, basically.
Yeah. It was weird, but it was because it couldn't fully descramble the channel, so it couldn't quite come in all the way. And yeah, basically that was good enough for me. And then once I got internet, I don't even remember how I even like got onto it, but it was like, I just somehow stumbled upon like different, you know, like once Dead or Alive 2 came out, like in, you know, 99, and like just, I think Dead or Alive 2 was definitely a big one for a starting point, just because that was very much like a fan service kind of game. And it was just a lot of fun just to find all that stuff online. And then it just kind of branched out from there. I just started looking more and more, finding like Disney characters and all kinds of stuff.
I mean like fictional pornography is just really cool in general. I mean, I much prefer it to sort of, I don't know, non-fictional pornography, I guess. Or one part of the appeal of fictional porn is that, you know, you can actually draw and you can create absolutely anything you want, and you get to explore a lot of sort of unrealistic types of sexuality, I guess. I mean, stuff you can't really depict in realistic media. But also, like, fictional porn is, you know, always abuse-free, right?
Yep.
Like, there's a lot of, I mean, sort of even stuff you'd find on, like, Pornhub, Xhamster, or whatever. Like, there's so much actual abuse involved in the production of even, like, really popular videos. Whereas with fictional stuff, it's, you know it's clean, you know, so there's no fear around that.
Plus, like, with fictional porn, like, there's characters, and that's a big draw for me. On Pornhub, there's not really characters.
No, yeah, no good tongues.
Yeah.
It's just, like, kind of random. It's just random people that I don't know who they are. And that's why when I do look at, like, stuff on Pornhub or whatever, I am most, I, when I can, I'm mostly drawn to cosplay stuff, because at least then they're trying to mimic a character in some way.
Yeah.
But yeah, like a character is a big draw for me, because like it has like a pre-established story, like, you know, like the character story, and like just kind of trying to imagine them having sex is fun.
It's really interesting how much of sexuality is not actually the copulation itself, right? But sort of also very rational interpretation of, well, the sex act. Right, and on what that means to you. So, like, when you have a character, you know, when you have a kind of story around the character, but that makes pornography into a sort of, or sex into a very, yeah, a rational act, right? Like, it's not just the fact of seeing sex, but it's the fact of what conclusions you draw from, you know, seeing this whole story, and how, you know, you find that in a more broad scale erotic. I think that's really fascinating. So, yeah, do you guys, so like, But from what I can tell you, like, Dr. X, you prefer the sort of, I guess, not foreplay, but...
A build-ups?
Yeah, build-ups of the sex. What about you, Hydra? Do you like the actual, like, acts of sex? Or the stuff that goes around it more, do you think?
I think both, honestly.
And I like both as well. Like, I can get off to just, like, seeing a penis go in vagina or whatever, or asshole. But, however, it is much more interesting if there's some kind of story or context. And that's usually what I try to go for. So either, like, some kind of character or, like, some kind of story. That's what I most enjoy.
All right, Sam.
With Hydro, like, with our games, we have tons of build-up, so we definitely enjoy that. Like, it's not just, like, you know, start the game and, like, the characters have fucking for no reason or something.
Just take a breath.
So we like having a reason for it to happen.
Yeah, and even in my comics I work on with Highware, DGen Comics, I still like to have, well, like, Pokemon's a great example. I don't know if you've read that comic yet, Sepeku, the Spoils of Victory comic. That's a Pokemon one that, yeah, I think you would love to read. But basically, the whole scenario of setting it up is what makes it more fun, because, you know, if it just started off with just a Lolly and the Shota just fucking randomly, I you know, it'd be fun. I'd still like it, but I think it's more fun when you give the context of it starts off just like a regular, like, Pokemon battle would, where, you know, it's like the Shota trainer is facing off against the Lolly trainers, and you know, it's just a Pokemon battle, but then all of a sudden it turns into a very lewd NSFW thing, and it just gets a lot more fun. That like excites me a lot more than just going straight into it.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting how much of Sora's of sexuality exists outside the fact of having sex itself. Yeah, I guess like I'm not that fussed about one night stands. Like, when I've had one night stands in the past, I just enjoy it significantly less compared to, you know, why I actually know a person. And yet, it just ties in again, like, with this thing, attraction and sort of sexual excitement. It's a strange mix of this sort of rational, imaginative and irrational processes, you know? Yeah, I just find it really fascinating.
Yeah, this has been a really fascinating talk. Yeah, I've loved it so far. So you have a Barag and a Pixiv, is that right?
I do have a Pixiv, but I don't particularly use it. I'm mostly on Barag. And
what's your username on Barag?
It's Sepeku. Supeku.
Sepeku on Barag. There's lots of very great lolly pics on Barag, and I can tell you're improving and experimenting, and that's really cool. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Like, you're experimenting with different, like, painting styles and drawing styles. So it's really cool to see your evolution. I think you're already a talented artist. So that's really cool that you've only started, like, last year, and you're already this far, and it seems like you're going to keep going.
Thank you. Yeah, that means what?
Yeah, so everyone go check out his page and see his great art. He's got lots of good stuff there.
Yeah, and see his progress.
Yeah, thanks, Clint.
Yeah, it was great having you.
Thanks for listening.
Because I think it's going to be fascinating to see your progress over the, you know, the next year and, you know, the future, too. It's going to be fascinating to look at.
Yeah, thanks. I've got some sort of larger projects lined up to the future, and I'll hopefully start working on in the next year.
Awesome. And we'd be happy to plug those projects if you'd like in the future once you get started.
Sounds good. Yeah, thank you. And yeah, like, again, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, us too. And thank you for being on.
Cheers. Yeah, thanks.